All right, you know what I think we should do?
An intro.
An intro to the stand-up, Prime.
All right.
You got this.
Are we doing a podcast?
We're doing a podcast today every Wednesday and Friday live on Twitch, 11 a.m. The stand-up happens, and today we have a special assortment of guests. We have Teej, as always. Say hi, Teej.
I like when you say that the stand-up happens every day, but then you say it's Wednesdays and Fridays. That one's... You didn't say that this time, but you've said it the last few intros. Anyways, hi.
Actually, this is the second time I said what day it happened, so guess what?
No, I know. Last
You're
time you
wrong
said
with
every
few.
No.
Oh, we're being technical. Hi, I'm
Josh,
technical
bring
TJ.
It back. Bring it back from the last episode.
Stand-up, which is streamed every day, Wednesday at 11 and Friday at 11 a.m.
You literally said it happens every day.
Every day.
Wednesdays and Fridays. Which
so what we've learned, okay, what we have learned today... This is insane. What we've learned today is that when Prime does actually do the intro correctly, Teej will then immediately derail.
Torpedoes it. He torpedoes it.
What
that
the hell?
Derailed.
This was our one chance. The plane was, like, leaving the runway, and you were like, I'm going to be the chicken that flies into the engine.
And see, here's my question. Is this called the stand-up, or is it called the well-run meeting?
Good point.
Anyways, sorry. All right. We also have with us Casey, as usual. Say hi, Casey.
Hi, Casey.
I knew one of you sons of bitches would do that. And a very special guest today, which is Ryan. Is it Flure?
That's perfect, actually.
I was leaning into it, yeah.
Yeah, I knew it was French. I didn't know how, like, what you gotta do with that, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyways, say hello, Ryan Flure.
Hello, Ryan Flure.
Nice.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Thank you. And today, we have a very special topic. It's one of those evergreen topics. We're gonna be talking about debuggers. And since I'm a printf debugger, TJ, I don't know what he is. Casey, definitely a debugger. Ryan Flure is the one who writes the debugger, so we figured he'd be the best single person to bring on and help us understand all the buggers. Ryan, I have a very important question to kick this off.
Okay.
Is printf debugging an abomination towards man, or is it a perfectly viable strategy?
Well, yeah, I think so. The first thing I would probably say to introduce someone to the topic, if they had just started programming and they're like, they figured out how to insert log statements into the program to sort of see what happened. The first thing I would say is that there's no dichotomy between that and what a debugger is offering. Like, there's no dichotomy between logging and what a debug, like the information that a debugger is actually getting. The only variable is what work you actually had to do in order to get a log of information out of your program. And so the first thing I would describe about a debugger is that it's collecting a log of information from your program in a sense. It's just another program on your computer that's running, and it's running alongside your actual program, the program you care about that you're working on. And it's sitting there collecting information from your program, and it's really in a log-like fashion. So, now there are technical constraints about that, because obviously the debugger has to collect information without modifying the actual program, because it's running with it live and collecting information. So there are limited ways in which it can modify the program. Some of that, varies depending on how well the kernel facilitates that process and stuff like that. But, the point is it's collecting the same kind of information. At the limit, when debuggers, can't go too far, you do have to go back into your program and say, okay, now I'm going to printf here and here and here and here, or like generate a log or plenty of other, versions of that exist. But so it's not that like team debugger versus team logging. It's very much like people should kind of remove that boundary from their heads, because the degree to which debuggers could theoretically do logging is I think more extreme than people, maybe if they're just getting used to the idea of a debugger, they might not realize. So it's not an abomination, although I think it's a lot slower than the tools that debuggers do offer you in a lot of cases. That's how I would put it.
This is hard for my American mind because I only know red versus blue. So this is like really, this is really difficult for me to have some sort of nuanced answer.
Well, I mean, go ahead, Ryan.
I was going to say you can re-slice it so that red is the people who think that there's a red versus blue, and then or vice versa. So you're on team red, which knows that there's no red versus blue, but blue is all the people who do, and then it's just another red versus blue problem. Because I'm American too, so that's how you that's how you do that.
Okay.
This makes me want to like light up a barbecue and eat apple pie.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't forget the Coors Light.
I would never. Only the finest microbrew.
All right, someone has to have a real question here to kick this bad boy off.
Well, I would keep going on that front, actually.
Hey, Deej, just finished the front end. I'm going to get the back end in JS. Could you give me the database?
That's Node problem. You got it, boss.
That was a mess without type safety. I rewrote our back end in TypeScript. Could you fix up the database? I'm going to fix the ESLint errors.
Not any problem for me. I got this.
Deej! AI is so hot right now, and my professor's helping us rewrite our backend in Python. Could you get a database up for me?
Certainly, I would love to assist you. You're correct. Let's delve into this.
Hey, Teej. Python scaled worse than TypeScript. We're gonna need Go. Could you give me a DB?
Fast, predictable, boring? I'm ready to go.
Hey, Teej. We're shipping a lot of features lately.
I know, maybe too many features. I'm worried they don't need both of us.
We need to slow down, but we need to look smart.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
You don't want your tools to pick your stack? Neon does serverless Postgres. You choose the rest. Get your free plan at neon.com.
So there are some issues. Like, one of the reasons why I think people like printf debugging and say, I don't want to use the debugger or I don't see the point of it. There are some valid, like, I think those come from a valid place, but they're not actually describing the problem correctly. So the valid place they're coming from is the fact that the debuggers often suck. Okay. So, like,
yes.
Like, I have complained about Linux debuggers many times, and that is in comparison to Windows debuggers, which also usually kind of suck. Like, Linux is, like, ultra-suck debugging, but Windows debuggers historically have also been pretty darn crappy. And so, you know, one of the things that's important to recognize is that debuggers could give you your printf debugging way faster than you actually writing your printf debugging if they weren't sucking so bad, but oftentimes they are sucking. So, when I am on Linux, for example, I use printf debugging a lot more, right?
We'll clip it and
a
ship
lot
it.
More.
All we need is Casey saying, I use printf debugging. Don't give the context.
Okay, sorry. It needs to be a clean thing. And the reason for that is because the debuggers are so bad. If I'm on Windows and I have something where I can do my data collection really efficiently because there's good debuggers, largely thanks to Ryan now, but also thanks to the George Menhorn, the guy who wrote Remedy BG, which is a debugger that I've been using previously. When you have a debugger whose user interface and design is set up to get you the information that you need very quickly, it will beat the speed of printf debugging. Because the amount of time it takes you to go add those printf lines, recompile the program, rerun the program, see where it prints out, I should have a few more printfs, and then you go back in there. That speed, you can be way faster than that to collect the exact same information with a debugger if the debugger is actually good. Now, if the debugger isn't good, it won't beat that speed, and then I am right there with everyone who's like, why would I use a debugger? Yes, like, you're right, because the debugger is too freaking slow. And so part of, like, what Ryan's project is with the Rad Debugger, for example, is to stop having that choice around. It should just be a given that the debugger will collect the data for you way faster than you could have collected it by instrumentation. But the sad reality is that a lot of times currently it isn't, especially on Linux, but also for certain circumstances on Windows as well. Thank you, Ryan, for actually tackling this problem for us.
So when I say I use printf debugging, that's the exact same thing as saying I use Arch, by the way?
Oh.
It's like very,
no,
very,
I wouldn't
very
necessarily
close.
Go that far. I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I wouldn't go that far.
All right. So, Ryan, are you actually trying to provide us a solution, us Linuxites? Linuxes?
Yeah, that's like, so.
Linusations.
Linusations,
right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually like, and if you go back and look at, I think it's on Web Archive at this point, but if you go back and look at the Rad Debugger's, like, original, like, pitch page where they actually described the project, that was one of, like, the primary ambitions of the project all the way back then. I think this would be, like, 2013 or something. And I was nowhere near the project. I was in high school. So I was, like, not even working on the project. But all the way back then, if you go back and look at what the original ambitions of the project were, it's like, let's get a viable debugging solution on Linux. And so that's still part of the ambition. And that's actually, like, I'm starting to work on that, not quite full-time, because there's a lot of stuff to fix and everything. I mean, with a debugger in general, there's, like, hundreds of possible problems you could work on at any point in time. But I'm starting at this point, it's gotten stable enough on Windows that I'm starting to do more of the Linux port work. And so I have, like, the UI running, and I'm starting to do process control, and we have Dwarf debug info parsing and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's actually going to happen. Like, it'll show up at some point soon.
Before we go further, I think there's a lot of people who don't know anything about Rad Debugger or Ryan or other stuff. I know we jumped right into the printf controversy. We wanted the hot take, but maybe we can just take a sec. You can walk us back a little bit. You can talk about maybe Rad Debugger and give people some info of what's going on. Casey's mentioned it like 1,000 times on the channel, so I think we gotta tell people what it is. You know,
and is it Epic Games Debugger now, or is it still Rad Debugger?
It's called Rad Debugger, but that's sort of just historical. Epic bought Rad Game Tools back, actually, shortly before I joined. So I was never technically a part of, like, Rad proper. But Epic owns it now, but it's still called the Rad Debugger because, I don't know, that's just that's what they just, I don't know. Nobody's told me that it should be renamed, so I haven't renamed it. But yeah, I mean, basically, like, the story of the project is, it started with what I said, like, they wanted a viable, to my knowledge, I wasn't even near the company at this point, so.
I was there if you want the actual story.
Yeah, maybe you should do that early, and then sure. I can say what happened after.
Yeah. So what happened specifically was, and this'll just show you, remember the idea of the Steam, like, the Steam PC, like Steam Linux? Do you remember this? Way, way back? Like, way, way back. In, like, the early 2010s, they were, like, gonna ship this Steam Linux set-top box thing. And it never really materialized. Like, some IHVs kind of did, but it never became a thing. And then, like, fast forward to today, and they redid, like, sort of a similar plan to that. And with similar people, like, I think Pierre Liu and those guys were same. I think it's, like, similar team did do the Steam Deck, and that has hit. Like, that worked, and they are going with it. But way back, there was this sort of idea that they were gonna do a Steam Linux distribution. This is where it sort of actually started, because obviously Rad does a lot of cross-platform stuff. They have to ship on Linux as well as Mac as well as XXX. Like, in fact, when I worked at Rad, it was dizzying the platforms we support. Like, I'd build, you know, the character animation system, and it's just a laundry list of platforms. It's like 14 long or something like that. So that was where I learned cross-platform programming, like, the hardest way, right? I had a little bit of experience before, but that was the big one. And so Rad and Valve were always historically very close. Like, Jeff and Gabe, so the two heads of the companies, used to have lunch pretty regularly. So they were never, like, at each other's throats at all. They were not competitors, really, or never thought of themselves that way, because they didn't really operate in similar business spaces. So they were actually fairly close, and oftentimes they would even share employees sometimes. So there would be times, like, for example, on the VR projects, where some of the Rad people were still technically Rad employees, but, like, Valve would pay their salaries, and they were at Valve. There was all kinds of stuff like that. So it was kind of closer than people know about, because it's, you know, there's not, like, this is secret or anything, but just, like, you know, it doesn't get written about, or no one cares, or whatever. So because that was a very, like, closely, you know, they talked a lot, there was this idea, because Valve really wanted to do Linux stuff, and there isn't great debugging tools that game developers are used to. And again, we also need a lot of specialized debugging tools for debugging things like 3D geometry and this sort of stuff. So we need things like GPU intervention stuff, and we need things like to be able to visualize vectors and all this other stuff that you might not need. So we need ways to add that, too. So how are we going to get this stuff? And so what Gabe and Jeff decide is they're going to do a debugger project to get a good debugger going on Linux, and Valve's going to fund some of it, and Rad's going to fund some of it, and it's going to happen at the Rad offices. So they expanded the Rad offices. They added, there's, like, a new, like, area that got added on. They, like, grew and took over a little bit more of the floor. I assume people seem to like when I go on ridiculous story time, so I'm just telling the whole story. If this sucks, you can stop me at any point. You edit it out.
It's okay. Great. We love it. Okay. We love it, Casey.
Yeah.
So they expanded on YouTube. If you love,
I
this.
Love the okay. BC. Yeah, I love the BC, and I can't wait for the AD coming up. So I'm
yeah.
I'm
well,
super
Ryan will take
sides.
The AD. We're gonna hand it off, and then Ryan's gonna do the AD. and so they had some people there, but it was always hard to get a team of people who actually would, like, get it to the point, like, where it needed to be, and like largely that was because. Debuggers are kind of, I guess if I had to describe them, they straddle a really uncomfortable boundary. D's nuts jokes aside, the straddle is very uncomfortable for a lot of programmers if they have to tackle it sort of holistically might be the way. Or head on, let's say. If they have to come at it from the front, then this straddle is very difficult.
I just have to say, Casey, yeah. You've been hanging out with us a lot, and I love this.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like I'm allowed to say these sorts of things here, so I do.
Yes, it's a safe space. It's a safe space.
So, what I mean by that is it's a project that crosses between UI sort of like, I need to know how to create visualizations and interactive things that show a lot of information in highly structured ways. If I had to rank programs by what is the hardest kind to write the front end for, it's actually debugger. It is literally the hardest problem that I know of. If you wanted to see if a UI programmer is actually great or just kind of mediocre, have them try to do a debugger and see what you get out of it, right? Because it is I do not know of a harder problem that you would have to solve other than debugging, really, right?
Ryan agrees wholeheartedly. He's like, you're so right, Casey.
100%. Yeah, totally. 100%.
I mean, maybe you could argue that like 3D editor, like Blender, because it integrates the 3D part, like those are the two that come to mind, and they each have kind of different stress points. Ryan decided to do both by adding 3D visualization to the debugger, so that's where he's at. But you have the hardest UI problem or close to the hardest UI problem on one side, and then you have like system level process control, register inspection, module loading, and disassembly on the other side, which is all ultra low level, right? So when you put those two together, it's really hard to find a group of people who can actually go from zero to debugger. It's really, really difficult. And so the project never really got off the ground because it just didn't have the right mix of people to actually make that happen. I'll spare the gory details of that. But
can I jump in for one quick second?
As many seconds as you want. It's your show, Prime.
No, it's our show. But
I'm feeling the love over here.
Thank you. One reason why I've historically keep using Vim and then integrating DAP, debugger adapter protocol, and then not using it is because the Vim UI just does not feel currently kind of set up for debugger, because I do believe a debugger UI is a very visual experience. It is not like it's not just a separate buffers and text. There's more to it, and every time it just feels very clunky. So I agree with you. UIs are like super duper hard to be able to build.
Yes. And debugger UIs, because they have to marshal so much information, and the entire value of the debugger is can it allow you to edit that information display and update and present that information display as smoothly and as quickly as possible? Because there are plenty of debuggers. WinDBG would be a classic example of a debugger that has all the features under the hood and is largely completely unusable 99% of the time. Like, you will only fire it up if you need a feature that only it has, like time travel debugging. Otherwise, it's completely useless, because the amount of time it will take you to actually set it up to do the debugging you want, you could have just done your printf, right? Like, it's the canonical example of what we were talking about at the beginning, where it's like anyone who was given only WinDBG and was like, I pretty much only use printf debugging, I'm like, yep, me too. Yep, like, absolutely, right? So, so anyway, the project kind of languished as a result of this. So really not much actual usable work happened between, that when it started in the early 2010s and later. Now, I tried to hire Ryan, full disclosure, out of college. Like, not when he finished college, but while I was in college. I was like, hey, do you want to come work on this? And he turned us down. So that didn't work out. Eventually,
you just wanted him to come on the pod to air the dirty laundry, Casey.
Yes.
Yeah, I love
and
this.
Suck it, yes. Ryan. We hate your guts.
Yeah,
we hate you.
I came later. I don't know what to. What
I love
to
it.
Say.
No, I was so delighted. I was super happy, but I was so unhappy then. I'm like, damn it. All right, I should have been more aggressive. But anyway, so we tried to hire Ryan, and that didn't work out. But eventually, it does work out, and not only do we get Ryan, but we got Nick, and we also got Alan Webster. So, like, three people I picked. And also, I mean, I guess Martin's never really went on that project, but he was another person I tried to hire and succeeded. So out of those four people, that I tried to hire, we ended up getting all four. And through some combination of them, then they were basically able to reboot and successfully complete this project. Now it's like it's a totally usable debugger already, even though technically it's only an alpha, and they really haven't been working on it that long, because even though the project was very long, most of it was not actually usable. So anyway, Ryan can now pick it up from that sort of modern era. How did it happen?
Yeah, so I came on board in 2021, and I think Alan, I don't remember when Nick joined, but I think maybe Alan was slightly before Nick, but Alan and Nick showed up, and they were working on... Alan had inherited the project from Wan Chun, I believe. Yeah. And he had a bunch of stuff, and it's... The thing about debuggers is that there's, like, 1,000 problems. Like, you have to know how to parse debug info formats. Everything that Casey was talking about, you know, need to know how to do process control. Reading registers, even, is, like, more work than it might seem like it would be. And so they have
patching
all this
the binary too. Like you have to be like yeah. patch the binary for breaks and data breakpoints yep. and all this crap. It's huge.
Yep. Yeah. Like even how to implement like line stepping is already like that's a deep rabbit hole already. There was a ton of work done in that direction. And then once Juan had left, Alan and Nick worked together on a bunch of the problems around. I think Alan was focusing mostly on the debugger stuff. Nick was working on. Nick is really good at like. Reverse engineering, like how the PDB format stores certain things, or how do you do unwinding, you know, in this particular case, or all that sort of family of problems. Nick is really good at kind of drilling deep and figuring out how that actually works. So he was kind of working on that stuff. Alan was trying to think, like, work through the problem of, like, how do you actually build, like, how do you actually build an architecture for the actual debugger sort of engine, if you will. And then I joined, and my role initially was sort of like I was helping with a bunch of the debug info parsing stuff, but I was going to build the UI. Like that was the end goal. Like I would be on the UI, like the front end side. Alan would be doing the engine. Nick would be doing like debug info format parsing, unwinding, like figuring that stuff out. And for a while we were just working on debug info parsing. So that was 2021, and maybe 6 months in or 8 months in, I switched over to building like a little prototype debugger just so I could like familiarize myself with the problem space. That has been like thrown away. So that's no longer in the code base, but it was just like a really crappy little, like, let me figure out how you even do things like stepping. Like how do you actually specify how a step is even supposed to happen? And then Alan worked, the last thing he worked on before he left was the, we also have a custom debug info format. So both PDB and Dwarf, one of the problems you have to deal with debuggers, especially one that tries to ship to both Windows and Linux, is you have to deal with like the situation of the different tool chains. One of the realities of that situation is that these two different tool chains use completely different debug info formats, both of which are extremely complicated, and they're very different in how they actually organize and slice information. And so we had kind of always... talked, at least for, I'm sure they talked before I even got there, but while I was there also, we were talking about, like, this debug info format problem is really difficult to deal with, actually, and so if we could actually move to our own format instead, and if you start with PDB and Dwarf, you can convert to our format, and then build the debugger on that, and then it works everywhere. You don't have to deal with, like, an abstraction layer, for example, over incrementally parsing Dwarf or PDB. It gets really nasty really quick. We tried to do that, and then it was like, it turned out to be really complicated. And so, the last thing Alan did was he designed the first version of that debug info format.
We should mention Alan's not there anymore. So that's why it's like the last thing he did, because he left
right.
shortly after that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then at that point, once he left, I was building the UI for the debugger. And then I just sort of took over the pieces that he had written. And I either took them over, rewrote them, or they kind of, like, you know, dissipated because, you know, it's just as the system evolves, if there was a layer that he wrote that I wasn't familiar with, I was like, I'm not really sure what to do with this, so I'll rewrite that part or whatever.
Understanding to replacement.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So I kind of, at that point, I took over most of the debugger stuff. Nick actually works on a linker. This is another very deep rabbit hole we could get into. So Nick works mostly on the linker, but he still does a bunch of like he built the Dwarf format to our debug info format called RDI. He built that converter recently. It's still early, but he did like a first pass on it. So he's working on problems that overlap with the debugger, but he spent most of his time over the past like year or two, maybe year and a half, on the linker. And then I've just been on the debugger. So, and the, I guess that's the story of the project. What it actually is it's a graphical debugger that you can debug your programs with.
So one thing that I think people... So one of the things that I was literally complaining about on Twitter just recently was people are like, well, game programmers just don't understand all like the real problems that banking people face or something like this, which is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard, and I'm really sick of it. But like, just to underscore how like much that kind of thing is ridiculous, I have not ever actually heard of any other project besides Fortnite that hit the limit of PDB.
Yeah.
So the literal output of debug information on Windows, Fortnite got so large as a project, it could no longer be built because the debug info could not be stored. I just want to...
There's a file limit size, right, that exists on Windows. So if you
no, it's not.
That...
It's not a file limit size on Windows. It's a file limit size in PDB. The way
it's like
that
one of the sections.
Yeah, one
they
of the sections.
32-bit. Yeah, they use 32-bit offsets. Actually, yes. They use signed 32-bit offsets into like it's like the one of the type information sections. And so once you get enough types, and especially once you're doing like heavy C++ template metaprogramming or lots of lambda functions, those generate types. Every single one of those generates types. And so you get this just massive expansion of type information.
Yeah.
And then you run out of that space like pretty quick once you're at
So which, JP Morgan, call me up and let me know when you had to write your own linker because you exceeded the PDB file size. I'll wait.
I was wondering, though, like, Ryan, which collab was it that pushed them over the limit? Was it, like, Star Wars? Or was it, like, which one was the...
That's a good question.
You know, oh my goodness, we've been all the Star Wars characters. Oops, it's the Pokemon collabs. You know, we gotta make sure it's got all the Pokemon.
You know, I think it might have been the Snoop Dogg skins, like, when they added the Snoop Dogg... You know, Doggy Dog skins. Yeah. That was like, that, this is too much.
It was when they stored all the Darth Vader voice lines that got them in trouble, right?
Yeah.
Sabrina Carpenter lyrics, they don't get compressed very well in the PDB, so the problem is like that just, and it was a problem, and it's fine.
But are most of the songs like six different words? So it
they just don't
like
compress very well because they're so creative, Teach.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, Teach. Got it. Sorry,
they're practically white noise. They're so creative.
Yeah.
they wanted to compute them at compile time, too. So each lyric word was a template instantiation.
Yes.
And so that's why there's so many types.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense.
So long story short, there are some pretty cool things about this that if you read between the lines are there that's really awesome. And I think will be very, very interesting to people going forwards. One is RAD did release the linker, which means that now if you want to bypass the entire crappy like Microsoft and or Clang linking scenario on Windows at least, and eventually presumably Linux, you can have a much faster linker that produces RDI. Is it RDI is the name of the file type or something?
Yeah,
directly. Yeah. So you can have that debug info, which is more efficient to use and much more like well documented and like this is easy, you know, it's easy to kind of get into. That's pretty awesome. But two, those RDIs also now there's like this convenient sort of thing you can look at where it's like, here's a code base. If you would like to access the debug information for your own programs, to write your own instrumentation tools, your own inspection tools, your own metaprogramming tools, whatever you want, now RAD has done that for you, or Epic has done that for you, right? And so this project has a lot more cool stuff in it than just the debugger because they chose to tackle a bunch of other hard problems at the same time and succeeded.
I got a question for you, Ryan. Someone who also worked at Epic but a different one, how often, like on a weekly basis, after you tell someone you work at Epic, do you get, whoa, bro, that's Epic? Every time, like, because I feel like you're like, guys, come on. Everyone said that joke already. You can relax.
Yeah.
You know?
It definitely happened. It's funny because I was wearing an Epic shirt to a hospital at some point.
Oh, and they're like, yes!
And they're like, hey, can you help us with this quick? Like, bro, just like fix my chart problems really fast.
Yeah. And it was one particular shirt design where you could see Epic very clearly from a distance, but you couldn't see the games part very clearly. And so they were like, oh, Epic. Yeah, we use Epic here. I was like, don't tell me they're putting on Real Engine, like, in the MRI machines or whatever. Like,
it's a brand new therapy. We put them on Fortnite. It's like the days go so fast. Before you know it, you're healed. You know, it took 6 months. But
all the surgeons are, like, flossing in the room. Like, they're, like, doing stuff. And you're like, what is happening? And they're like, it's an emote. Sorry, don't worry about it.
they right, always emote after a surgery.
Yeah, like, yeah,
crushed
yeah.
it, bro.
Yeah, yeah. New heart, new heart, new heart, new heart. Closed up that valve. Mm.
All right, so I actually have a pretty serious question. Since you do work at Epic, do you get free Fortnite?
Isn't Fortnite already free?
Yes, the Sabrina Carpenter skin. Can you get that for free? Is what he's asking.
Just asking for a friend, okay?
I see. I see. I haven't tried, but I can. I can. I can check for you. I'll let you know.
My Epic, they had my favorite phrase, which was "Consider your salary a stipend for that." Like whenever people are like,
"Are you kidding me?"
Why isn't gym membership included in our paycheck, right? Because, like, that's the big tech thing to do is, like,
right.
we're going to micromanage your life and give you $100 extra a month to pay for, like, a gym.
Right.
And
right.
I loved Judy on stage, like, 12,000 people answered one time, like, consider your salary a stipend for that. And I love that so much. I'm like, yes!
They're like, what do you think we are, some kind of healthcare company here?
Well, they did give really good health insurance. I missed that after I left. They were like, you know, but yes.
But it was good. They probably just hack into, like, it's running all the systems. It's just they set all their employees to $0 every time, right?
Yeah.
It's like, we're providing healthcare.
Zero. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The other thing about the Epic misunderstanding, TJ, is not – so – you probably don't have this side of the problem. So they're like, oh, you work at Epic. And it's like, no, not that Epic. The one who makes like Unreal. And they're like, oh, that's Unreal. So there's like two words they can
back
say.
To back.
Yeah, exactly. Dang. So it gets rough. But
I just had look of like intense sadness when they found out I didn't make Fortnite. Like the only thing they thought they were going to be able to connect with me on, like I'm a software developer. I work at Epic. And they're like, oh, cool. Something interesting. And I'm like, no. Electronic medical health records, and I work in an insurance and billing section.
Yes,
they're like, well, that's kind of cool too. It's like almost like making the world's biggest video game. It's almost there. What language do you write in? Oh, mumps.
The conversation's over.
I did a little bit of programming in college. What is it? C++? C? Oh, mumps. Oh, okay. Mumps.
What the hell is mumps?
That's the language that they use at Epic.
Oh, that's right, Casey. You weren't there for when we talked about...
The hell is mumps? That's a disease.
Why is a healthcare company programming in a language that's named after a disease? What the hell is happening?
Casey, but this is like, why do programmers think of dumb names? Because they're stupid.
What is
like,
mumps? Tell me, no, I want to know what mumps is though now.
It stands for like Massachusetts University Multipurpose System or like something like, it's like some, they made it at some hospital in like the 70s or something like this. Okay. I don't remember exactly.
All right.
And so they don't call it mumps anymore for exactly, they call it M. But it's
that's
mumps.
Not better.
They just call it M.
That's very confusing.
Well, yes, I'm...
Yeah, which is James Bond now? Like, it's like, that's Q and that's M.
They also skip, like, D, E, F, G. Like, they start at C and now they're at M.
Okay, yes, but
confusing.
Guys, there's trade-offs. The option is presenting the doctors with, this was built with mumps or this was built with M, okay? they're going to say something. Fine, sometimes they say InterSystems Cache because that's one of the people that provide it, all right?
I would just like to point out that basically all of the D language stands out there are now furious at Prime for saying they skipped D. Wow, that's gonna hurt some people.
Dude, one of them.
Wow, yeah, seven of you in the comments. Let us know that you've written a line of D.
Oh my god!
Wow. Oh, we have garbage collection and manual memory management. Oh, but you don't have users, okay?
Yeah. So, hey, what's one thing that both C++ and Rust users can agree on? D sucks, right? Like it's very simple.
Oh my god, you guys! All right, I'm not involved in this. This is nothing. I don't want to have a fight with D people.
We're cutting that out. We're putting the whole thing in here, and we're putting in a you laughing. We're just going to splice you out of context.
Oh, yes.
I should never have let you guys have edit. Never have been able to edit
these. Do you actually know anything about D?
Me?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. You can just say what's D.
A very little bit.
You can just say that if you need to.
What?
Casey, but explain this then. If you're such a big fan of D, then why is it not D moratory?
Yeah,
I'm not a fan of D. I'm just saying, like, I don't.
Oh, we got him! He's not a fan of D. Cut it. Listen up, boys. Put it in. Oh,
All right, well, thank you, D-Moratori, for that. You know, I'm not going to lie to you, Ryan, you've been suspiciously quiet about Oodle. Could you please explain why you haven't talked about Oodle once yet?
What? He doesn't work on Oodle.
Yeah, I don't work on it.
Obviously, you'd use the compression in all of your debugging, so I would assume so, at least.
I don't actually, like, the only thing, I use, like, one header file that Jeff gave me for compressing, but I don't even think it's any of the Oodle stuff. Okay. It's just, so I'm very Oodle adjacent, if you will.
Do you want to talk about Oodle Prime?
We could
ask Charles or Fabian. Okay, I'm like, they would come on, probably. One of them might. I don't know if you want to talk about Oodle. But
I just wanted to ask an Oodle question at some point, okay? It was very important to me because it's such a funny name.
Okay, we'll do an Oodle stream next time. This time, though, could we talk about debugger information stuff? Because I'd like to talk about that.
I actually will. Can I do a real follow-up question?
Please.
You said something, Ryan, inside your talk, which is how do steps work? And I thought the same thing. I'm like, how do magnets work? How do steps work? And so can you explain why that's such a tremendous problem?
Yeah, so I don't know what a magnet is exactly. Maybe
yeah, no one
you
does.
Don't have to answer that one. It's not possible.
This is not okay. Gonna be, we don't want this to become a Christian stream right now, so please don't answer that question.
They all don't right. know the reference, Prime. They don't okay. know the reference.
No, he does know the reference. That's why he said that.
No, I don't think he knows the reference. Take a look at this fine creation
and enjoy it better with appreciation. I don't think I know
magnets work. He doesn't know. That's fine. Neither does Chad. Move on.
Okay, got it. Okay,
That was the perfect response if you did know, though. That was, like, so good, because we don't know how magnets work. I mean, no one does, right? That's the whole point.
Yes, I see. Thank you, Casey.
I see.
All right.
Okay, all right, so I can explain how...
Let's get back to this. How do steps work?
Okay, so stepping... So line stepping is... Okay, I guess the first thing to understand about the problem of stepping is sort of how a debugger interacts with, like, another running program in, like, another native running program on an operating system. So, basically, the debugger has the opportunity to, like, make changes to memory and make changes to registers, and then it can suspend or resume certain threads. Like, you can basically set up certain threads to run or others to not. And then it just says go, basically. It can just say to the operating system, okay, now you can schedule this program's threads again. And then, like, the debugger loses all control at that point until that program does something that would cause the kernel to transfer control back to the debugger. And so if you think about what it actually means to, like, step over a line of source code, first you have the problem of, like, locating where the... like, where a thread's instruction pointer, because you're stepping a thread over some line of source code that it's on. First, you have to, like, extract the register value that stores the instruction pointer of whatever thread you're stepping. You have to then understand where that actually map, like, what source code that actually maps to. Once you know that, you know the range of addresses that are associated with that particular line of source code that thread happens to be stopped on. And then you have to say, like, you know, let me, basically, I have to produce the effect that this thread will stop execution, like the program will stop execution when this thread leaves this line of source code. Now, a very naive algorithm you could do to do that is would be to say there's something on CPUs where you can single step a thread, which at that level, it's just stepping over one single instruction, and then it immediately interrupts. So you can basically set a bit in one register on the CPU, and you can say, okay, step over one instruction and then stop.
Can I interject one thing real quick here for the folks at home? So just to be clear for anyone who hasn't looked at this kind of thing before, so when you have a line of source code, a compiler is turning that into potentially many assembly language instructions that will actually be executed by a CPU. So there's this mapping, and not only is it a like one to potentially many mapping, meaning one line of source code could produce many assembly language instructions, but also in more sophisticated builds, like when you're running an optimizer, those assembly language instructions do not occur in a chunk. So it's not like going from one to like three instructions in a row. It could be going from one of your source lines to several instructions peppered throughout other instructions it has been mixed with that come from other lines of source code, right? Yep. So the mapping is very messy. And one of the reasons that debug information is not a super easy problem is because the whole point of that thing that Ryan was talking about before with PDBs and Dwarf, like this debug info that gets produced when you build your program, one of the reasons that's so messy is because that is trying to store in some way that a debugger can use, among many other things, how do you go from a line of text that the user typed into Vim, right, to which assembly language instructions the CPU is going to execute, which ones it caused. Because when you're going through an optimizer, it's combining instructions, it's like removing instructions, it's reordering instructions. And so even just that one part is messy. So everything Ryan's talking about now when he's saying how do you go from one to the other, like, just keep in your head that it's a very messy mapping between those two. That's all I wanted to throw in there.
I had to also throw in just a quick question to answer along the way, which is when you break point or you hit some sort of stopping condition and you're in the middle of a line, does that ever happen as well? Like where you're just like, I'm halfway through a line, what line do you appear on? Does that screw up debugging information that causes confusion? I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, so that definitely does happen. And it can even happen, like, for example, if you step out of a function call. Like, you're inside of a function, you want to return to whoever called you. Generally, like, there might still be some instructions to execute after you've actually popped from the call. So if you do a step out operation, you'll end up in the middle of the line. You're not just at the first address of the line's source machine code. You might be at some instruction in the middle. And so basically that's just an extra wrinkle in the problem. You don't, it doesn't really screw anything up, but you just basically have to say, like, this is a range of instructions. And if the thread ends up anywhere in here, I have to associate that with this particular line of source code. So it's one detail in the mapping, but it's not like a showstopper by any means. So yeah, if you wanted to step over a line of source code, if you wanted to like basically precede this thread until it has exited this particular line of source code, one simple thing would be to single step that thread until you see it has left the line. Like you just keep mapping the instruction pointer every time it comes back, and then if it leaves the if it's changed the source code line that it's on, then the step is done. So that's a very simple algorithm. It also is enormously slow, because remember that each one of these interrupt instructions that comes back, each one of the single step, after a single step has completed, basically what's going to happen is the kernel is going to schedule that thread, and it's going to say, okay, execute one instruction. It's going to immediately trigger an interrupt. The kernel will then, it'll switch to the kernel, and the kernel will say, okay, now I need to report this debug event to the debugger, so it has to transition, it has to context switch over to the actual debugger itself. And so every single time you do a single step, it's one of these round trips, you can think of it as, between the debuggee or the target process and the debugger itself. And so if you've got a line that has 100 or 1,000 instruction, I mean, you know, you can make it arbitrarily long, really. You know, you're causing a round trip every single time someone, every single instruction within that line. So that gets very slow. So instead, what you kind of want to do is say, like, I'm going to set up a bunch of, there's another concept that I should introduce, which is the int3 instruction on x64, but there's equivalents elsewhere, where you can basically put it's a 1 byte instruction that you can use to overwrite any instruction, basically, because it's just 1 byte. So it's the minimum instruction size. And you can go ahead and say, I'm going to put this here. And then when the thread executes this instruction, it's called an int3. And when it, there's other kinds of interrupt codes, but int3 specifically is this 1 byte instruction that you can put anywhere in the code stream. And when a thread executes that, it'll immediately interrupt. So it has the same effect sort of as the single step, except it's caused by an instruction you put in the code. And so then so in order to avoid all of these round trips, what you can start doing is saying, when the thread is in this line and I say step over this line of code, I'm going to basically set up it's called an int3. It's also called a trap, is what people call it. So what you can basically do is start putting these traps anywhere you think the thread might go within this line. Now, if it's pure linear code, like it's going to do a bunch of mavs and then an add and then, you know, whatever, very simple linear code, there's only one trap you actually have to place, which is at the beginning of the next line. But it starts to get more complicated if you, for example, if inside of that line of source code you've got a jump instruction or a call, then you have to start thinking about, like, where are all the places this thread might actually go to? And so then you might have to start doing things like, okay, let's disassemble the line. Let's figure out, like, where the control flow will lead to in this line. And let's go place traps in all of those places. And then it gets a little bit more complicated, too, because, for example, if you're in a recursive function call, like, so two variants of stepping exist for people who haven't used debuggers. There's step over and step into. There's a lot of other steps you might imagine doing, but those are the two, like, common ones. And step out. Step over will basically, it won't follow call instructions. So if you do a step into, you're sort of stopped at a function call, and you want to go into the function call and see what's actually happening inside of the function call. With a step over, you don't care about what's going on inside the function, so you just want to step to the next line and have whatever happens inside the function happen. Now, if you wanted to do a step over, you could imagine if you are in a function that is recursive. And remember, a debugger has to deal with any code that someone could write and feed into it. Like, it has to kind of handle all these cases gracefully. There's lots of recursive code that exists. So if you're stopped at one particular line and it's a recursive call into the same function, it gets more tricky, because if you just place a trap at the next line and then you try to step over, you're going to hit that same trap address, but in one layer deeper in the call stack. So you basically have descended to the next call, hit the same trap, but it wasn't actually a step over. Because the step over, it didn't step over the line, it didn't step over all of the call work that happened. Now you're one layer deeper in the call stack, so there's no way anymore to actually step over that line of code. So you have to get tricky about, like, okay, has my stack pointer changed? When do I update which value of the stack pointer that I want to check against? It becomes kind of basically like a little program you have to send down and say, like, if it hits this trap, do this, and if it hits this trap, do this, and if it hits this trap, then single step here, and, like, it becomes a very complicated sort of state machine that you actually have to implement.
So hold on. Get one more? Oh, no, TJ wants it.
No, I just got just a quick question. I was just wondering, like, on average, what your step count is every day. You know what I'm saying? Like, because for me personally, like, I don't know if this makes me a debugger, like a step debugger or not, but, like, I've got my own, like, walking treadmill now at my desk.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if this is kind of like what scenario this kind of goes on. So I just didn't know how this related to debugger. Does this make me a step-driven debugger? Like, if I'm
You're stepping into, you're not stepping over. We're talking about stepping over right now, TJ.
Okay, I'm trying now.
There you go.
See, yeah, like, I'm trying to step
that's
over.
That's the harder one to do.
Which one is harder? How do I do recursive treadmills?
You're on an int 3 and it's inside
the
stack.
You put that treadmill on a treadmill.
Oh, that makes so much more sense. And then it's running too.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
I got it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So anyways, you can continue now. Thanks.
Yeah, okay. TJ, how long? Okay. Now we have a sub question. Now our stack has been pushed. TJ, how long have you been waiting for that? And also, you have just a black square in your screen.
So
I saw you raise it like 10 minutes ago.
Immediately after we started talking about step stuff, I put it into standing mode, and I was getting ready. I had to set up that scene. I did not have the video thing ready before
this.
So I probably heard about 5% of what Ryan said, but I was so excited for this job.
Wow. Okay.
I was so excited for this one.
That is some serious professional level podcasting. All right.
So when it comes to stepping and putting in all these in threes, do you also have, like, because I don't precisely understand how jump instructions work. I believe there are relative and absolute ones. Does that mean you also have to update all the relative instructions around all these places that you put these in threes? Because theoretically, you shifted down some amount of the assembly.
So
you're not inserting.
Okay, yeah. I thought you were dynamically at, like, runtime being like, okay, like, they're stepping next. Let's actually insert some stuff
over,
in the program.
You're overwriting it. You're over. That's why it's crucial that in3 has a one-byte version, because you're romping it over the instruction. One of the things Ryan didn't mention, because he had to mention, like, 8,000 things, because this is incredibly complicated, is that actually when you put that in3 in there, you have to remember which byte you overwrote, because once you are done stepping, you have to go replace all of those with the bytes you overwrote. So that happened as part of this process.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so does that mean when you literally overwrite assembly, and then when it hits that int, you then have to put back in the correct assembly so that it, when it executes the line, it correctly executes the line?
Correct.
That's crazy, dog. That's crazy.
I don't know. It sounds like probably debuggers, it's as easy as making a regular CRUD app, guys.
Dude, have you seen a banking app, though, Ryan? Do you have any idea about a banking app?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. It's just...
That's like magnet level stuff right there.
How do banks work? Actually, we don't know.
If you would have been paying attention to Twitter, Lori Wire just tweeted how AHC works, which is literally FTP. So
yes.
All right.
We do now know how banks work.
Yes, we do. That's why it... Anyways.
So underlying all of this, right, is like... This is also why... You may have noticed there was a little snippet of Ryan at the Better Software Conference doing a little thing with Wukash where he asked him, like, what was the one OS feature that you would like to have that you don't have right now? And Ryan said, I would like to have user level int 3. And it's like, what is that, right? And that underlies this entire thing. So what happens is, in the CPU, right, there's this thing called the interrupt table, or there are things called interrupt tables in CPUs, right? And the reason for this is, right at the beginning, this is in, like, 8086. Like, the original 8086 chip has this. This is not, like, a new thing. They've been upgraded over time to have different capabilities, but generally speaking, this exists for a very long time. So they have these tables because what you often want to do is you wanted to have some kind of, like, supervisory system level, or should I say lower level code, operating system code, whatever. You want to have some code that you can trigger from anywhere instantaneously, meaning you don't have to, like, know in advance that you were going to use this code at this time. Right, a call is when you know you're going to use it. At this point in the code, I call this function, right? This is like, we have no idea what we're going to do. We just suddenly have to do it. And one of the big reasons for this originally is, like, servicing hardware. So the CPU has to read something from some bus on some hardware, you know, like the original keyboard input or whoever knows what's happening, right? And so what would happen is an interrupt, literally the reason it's called an interrupt, interrupt 3, an interrupt would happen that stops the normal execution, what the CPU was doing. It looks in a table for what it should start doing. It goes and does that, and then it resumes back to wherever it was in the program. It's literally what it sounds like. It's an interrupt. And this was used for doing things, like I said, like reading hardware and stuff like that, because bytes would, like, come into the CPU that it had to, like, look at right now. So it would stop the program, you know, this is back when you didn't have multiple cores or anything like that, right? Stop the program as it's executing right in the middle of whatever it's doing, go service this interrupt. It's called servicing the interrupt, right? Go jump to that code, do it, right? So what an interrupt really is it's basically, it's the same kind of thing as a function call, but it's one where you didn't know it was going to happen. It's a function call that happens out of nowhere. And the reason that this is very useful for something like debugging is because one of the things that a function call will do, right, is it's going to save what the instruction pointer was before it does the call. So it will put the instruction pointer onto the stack, right? This is a call instruction. We'll put the instruction pointer onto your program stack. It then transfers control over to whatever the, you know, location is you're going. So it changes the IP to point to whatever the function is that you wanted to call, does that, and then when it goes to do a return, it will pop off the stack whatever that instruction pointer was. So it's basically a thing that uses your program stack, your standard program stack, to track where you are in the program. That's a normal function call. An int can't do that because it doesn't even know if there is a stack. It's happening in the middle of any code. There may not even be a stack frame. You may not even be using the stack pointer as a stack frame at that time, technically, in 8086. So what it has to do is do some special work to preserve, right, like the IP in this way that will, like, we know we can preserve just what the instruction pointer is. Then we're going to go into whatever, we're going to look in this special table that the CPU literally has a hard-coded register that sells it where it is. So it's separately stored, right? We're going to go there, look up where we should go. And by the way, nowadays, we also look up a bunch of information like whether we should be transferring control to, like, a different level. Like, should we be dropping down to ring 0 from ring 3 and all this other stuff. Right? So there's all a bunch of crap in that table. And off you go. So the way debuggers are written currently, because they have to be, is on something like Windows, they are written as a user-level application. Which is fine, because that's roughly what you want. You don't want your debugger to crash to take down your whole system, right? You don't want CrowdStrike happening here, right? So you want the debugger to be running at ring 3 on Windows so that it's running up like a normal program, and if it screws up, like if Ryan on like the one bug he has, right? If you hit that bug and it crashes your system, you just want the debugger to crash. You don't want your whole system to blue screen. So it's good that it's doing this. But the problem there is it needs to do all the things that Ryan just says. it needs access to the memory. It needs to be able to put in like these things like int threes that will happen. And the problem is when you are at user level, right, the kernel doesn't want you doing stuff like messing with the interrupt table or, you know, saying that you're going to be the person who gets whenever an int 3 happens in this on this core, that you're the one who's going to get it or whatever, right? It didn't want any of those things for security and stability reasons. So as a result, the debuggers have to do all of the work that Ryan described through an API that the kernel will then use. You know, it takes your API calls and goes, oh, I see. You wanted me to tell you when this guy hits an int 3. So you go, you know, I'll let you access his memory through my memory mapping APIs. You go, you poke it in there. You poke your int3s wherever you want. Great. When the int3 gets hit, the kernel's the one who's going to get called, not the debugger. And then it's going to go through the API to let the debugger know that it happened. What this means is that now all of these things Ryan's talking about, every one of these traps that gets hit, is a full round trip. Debuggy is running at ring 3. The trap gets hit. The int 3 gets hit. It's got to drop to ring 0, wakes up the kernel. The kernel goes, wait, what is happening? Oh, right, this is a debugged executable. I know I should tell the debugger about it. Okay, let me re-switch the task over to the debugger's context. Let me wake up the debugger in ring 3 and resume execution of a debugger thread to handle this. The debugger then goes, what just happened? Oh, the kernel told me I had a trap. All right, let me go fix up the trap things. Let me set any new traps that I need, and then let me retell the kernel back at ring 0 to resume the debuggy. Back we go to ring 0. It then switches in the context of the debuggy back up to ring 3, and we resume where we were going, right? This is wicked freaking slow for so many reasons, right? And so what Ryan was talking about is, hey, man, what if we could just set the int 3 to just jump to something in the actual the person who's being debugged, that program? The debugger could, like, JIT compile some code that just does the trap operation that it wants to do and resets whatever it needs or anything else, right? Checks conditions, anything it wants to. We just set the int 3 to not do any of that. Don't tell the kernel, don't take a RIN transition, just jump right to that thing, do the stuff, and then resume. It would be so much faster. Getting rid of that, like, first ring transition, back up ring transition, back down ring transition, back up ring transition, right? It gets rid of all of that. So that's what he was asking for. And this would be like a huge feature. If there are any kernel devs out there watching, please add this. User level interrupt handling like this would be so useful. And then that thing, if it actually wanted to do that huge transition thing, can just have a syscall that it does called actually transfer control to the debugger, right? So anyway,
yep.
Whole big thing of coolness there. We can't do
all
it.
I got from that is horse and debuggy is slow. That's what I got, Casey.
So, I tried so hard, Ryan. I tried I so hard.
TJ also sense. Tried so hard. That's the problem.
That sorry.
Anyway.
Yeah, like one example of, so at a high level, what you might imagine doing in a debugger that uses that sort of where you want that kernel level feature would be if you set a breakpoint on a particular line of source code. If you like run your program within the debugger, you say stop here. That's like reasonably fast because those two or four transitions actually. You pay that cost once, and at the scale of like oh run to this line, it's not really noticeable.
And you wanted to come back to the debugger anyway, so it's like doing what you wanted roughly, right?
Yeah. So when that gets when you actually really have to pay that cost to a sort of prohibitive degree in many cases, is when you wanted to say, stop at this line of source code, but only if this condition is true. So conditional breakpoints are like super common debugger feature. And it's like kind of the first version of fancier stuff that a debugger would want to do. But this is where it gets really slow, because then basically the debugger can't like do this installation of code that checks the condition inside of the debuggy. And so what has to happen is it hits the int 3, controls transferred back to the debugger. The debugger checks the condition, it evaluates some expression, it like does whatever evaluation stuff it needs to do to check the condition. And if that condition is false, then it goes back to the debuggy. And so if you imagine you put this in a loop that's supposed to run a million times, maybe it happens instantly, normally, but because you're paying this round trip cost, every single time the thread hits that int 3, it just becomes like prohibitively slow. Now if you're doing it once per frame, like It's still worth it for debuggers to have conditional breakpoints today, but they're like dramatically pessimized just from this problem. But if that problem were addressed, you could start doing lots of other things. Like, Another thing, something like printf debugging, is profiling, like marking, inserting profiling markup in your program. Like if you wanted to say, oh, I want to sample the time here, sample the time here. Let me measure that. Build me a flame graph of this kind of this kind of thing. That is the same problem as print debugging, where it's like, okay, go back to the source code, insert the things that I was looking for, build the program, run the program, get back into the state that I wanted to be looking at, and then inspect the log. And then it's like, oh, I need to drill one layer deeper into this like flame graph here, but I didn't add the markup there. So let me go back to the program, add the markup there. And you can't do it too much. You can't do it at every function, for example, because then, you know, then that profiling cost will start adding up like dramatically, and then you won't even be able to see what the actual performance costs were. So what the debugger could do is like, let's just do that dynamically. In the debugger, let's say, add a line of markup here, like a sampling line here, add a sampling line here, and then it could gather that data completely dynamically. It'd be way faster to like drill down into problems when it's really uncertain what you need to be looking at, basically. So yeah, that's like the high level, what you would expect as the user if you had this kernel level feature, basically.
Yeah. And so what we have to do now, basically, right, if you want to do this kind of thing, you can still do it, but what you have to do now is you have to handle a crap ton more edge cases, basically. So what happens is, if you want to, you can still do effectively this by not using int3, right? Because remember, the important part about int3 is it's a one-byte instruction. So even if it's overwriting another one-byte instruction, it's okay. All the code will still work exactly as it should because you only have the int3 just exactly where it needs to be. And anyone who's like jumping to the byte immediately after that, doing something weird or who knows what, it's fine, right? Mm-hmm. However, if we wanted to implement a feature like this without the assistance of int3 or halt or any of the other instructions that go through a table and are one byte, right? There aren't very many. I think there might only be those two. I don't know if there's a third one, but anyway. On x86, anyway. So if you want to do that without this, and, you know, Ryan has looked at this sort of stuff, and this is the kind of thing people are currently doing, so this is how you have to do it, you have to input some kind of a jump or a call actual instruction there, which takes more than one byte. So you can still do everything we just said, but you have to overwrite the thing you were going to overwrite with several bytes, potentially. And when you do that, now you run the risk of, oh, if those several bytes overflow and go into the next instruction, that right. could have been instruction that someone was jumping to. So now we have to do all this checking to figure out, like, is someone jumping into the place that we had to overwrite to, and blah, blah, blah. So now what should have been a very straightforward extension of just patching in an int3 and everything works perfectly and guaranteed no problems, what should have been a perfect extension of that is now this huge, like, oh, did we catch all the corner cases? Oh, crap, it doesn't work in this one place. And now we got these bug reports from these guys who were doing this thing. And, like, you know, and so if the kernel could just add this feature, all of that complexity goes away. And there's, like I said, so this is a thing that people have done. It's not like you can't do it. It's just it turns what would have been a very simple problem into a very complicated problem. And so that's why it would be great if the kernel could do it.
Kernels are great at that.
Yes. That's why we call them kernels, because they're like a kernel in a military thing where they... I don't actually know.
Yeah, I like it, Casey. One. Keep going. We'll cut it out in post.
Where does
Try
the kernel
again.
Keep shoot his it. Armies?
Shoot for it again, Casey. Here, it's like the kernels are great at that.
Yeah, just like... we're going to take it, mate. Beep!
Yeah. So are all these things you're describing effectively gone in things like JavaScript? Or in any interpreted language which has a VM, because then the VM can go, well, I can just insert an interrupt like right into the bytecode. I don't even have to worry about it since I'm processing these things. This do a lot of these problems effectively, because the Chrome debugger is actually shockingly a great debugger.
Well, okay.
Well, I mean, you got to remember you're debugging JavaScript. There's not like a lot, you know. It's.
I've had a lot. I've been not that happy with its accuracy in catching breakpoints and things like that. Actually, so I would not categorize it as a great debugger personally.
Really,
I would say it's a pretty mediocre debugger in my opinion.
You don't even program JavaScript. Don't even.
I do. I programmed a lot of JavaScript.
I already know that this is a trap. This is an int3. I am not getting bamboozled here, Casey.
I have used that debugger a bunch. I had to use that debugger on Electron even Prime. So I use it locally.
That might be different though.
Local that, Electron that be, fun, and that was a huge ball. Like that was great. Yeah, that was
fantastic.
Might
be different. I'm not.
It's
gonna,
not. It's the same. Yeah, but I've used both of them. Yeah. I feel like it is not reliable. It's not reliable at a couple things. restarting and catching breakpoints when a web page is reloaded, I have found it to be fairly unreliable, actually. And that's a very important thing, because if you're trying to debug stuff that happens at startup, right, like at load time, it just, and so, you know, it's one of those things where I didn't, when you use a debugger, you get this feeling of, is it solid or is it not solid, right? Not the SOLLD, like acronym, SOLLD's thing, not Liskov substitution principle, but like, is this thing reliable so that if I set a breakpoint, I know for sure that this code only got executed when the breakpoint got hit and no other time. And I definitely can guarantee you that was not true.
I think I can actually explain that one. One I think I can explain, because if you use the keyword debugger inside JavaScript, you'll actually get it every single time. But if you use the actual Chrome debugger to do that, it uses the CDP, the Chrome debugger protocol.
Okay.
And so it has to do some sort of async communication with your process, which if it loads fast enough, you're going to miss that entire plane, is what I'm like 99% sure that's what's happening, because I've ran into a bunch of these issues working on that protocol.
Also, now you run into the issues, Prime. At first, Casey said,
It is a great one if you use it correctly, right? I mean, come on.
But that you shouldn't have to, right? The point of a debugger is to save you time. If I have to go research why this thing can't set a breakpoint, it's like, oh, the thing that's supposed to set the breakpoint, you don't set breakpoints that way. You have to use this other thing that's not how you set a breakpoint to set a breakpoint. Like, then that's worthless. Because, again, I could have just done printf, which, by the way, is what I do. I do console.log when that kind of thing happens. So this is why I say I totally understand people who like go, I don't use debugger. It's like, yeah, because when the debugger is unreliable, it's not useful.
Yeah, for me, I just try to not write bugs in JavaScript, and that seems like all right.
So. Yeah, I don't have any bugs, so, you know, that's why I don't use debugger. I don't ever have any bugs, so I'm not really sure. Like, it's cool. If you have bugs, issue. I mean, you could use one, I guess. I mean, I don't
get
know.
It, yeah. I get why Prime might need one.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's because I always forget no mistakes. It's just like, if I could just add that to the end of my AI prompt, everything would be great. Yeah.
See, that's the problem. You got to put it in the agent instructions so no mistakes is in every one. See, make it secure, make it good, don't put it in a Firebase bucket with no authentication.
But also, if we could expound on why I don't think the Chrome debugger is very good. So, going further along those lines. So, again, in order for a debugger to actually be valuable, it has to do a lot more things than just stopping where I tell it to stop, which already it didn't do. So the other things it needs to be able to do is gather and like marshal and display information to me like cleanly and quickly, right? Okay. And it also doesn't do that very well. Like, yeah, it kind of has a watch window that's not absolutely horrible or anything, but it can't do any of the kind of stuff like I love, like all the rad debugger features where you can kind of go like, hey, here's my data structures. I want to turn that into tabular data. So like walk this linked list for me and show it to me like it was a table and like all that stuff. Like it can't do any of that stuff as far as I know. And if you wanted to do that stuff, you'd basically be like programming JavaScript. You know, you'd have to be like writing your own like JavaScript stuff to do that right in there, which again is taking me more time. I'd just do a console log. And so I think like, yeah, like Chrome debugger is pretty mediocre. I'm glad they built it, but it's not in the top tier. Like it's not an S tier debugger by any sort.
Oh, we got to come back with a debugger tier list. Casey, we're going to do that offline and we'll publish a video.
So
Ryan, actually, could we end with some of that? Can you talk a little bit about like the cool rad debug features? Because like some of that stuff is really cool. Most people don't know you can view like 3D models in rad debug, right?
Yeah. So the 3D model, so, like some of it's early. So the 3D model, it's solid, but it's. I need to work on each visualizer is like a complicated problem that I have to dig into later. And so, but I do have a 3D visualizer. So basically, the way it works is basically the debugger's got a watch window, and in the watch window you can enter expressions, and they show you can expand them and all that kind of thing. You can also extend these expressions with like visualizer rules. So if you wanted to view the very common example is viewing like pixel data or bitmap data. If you wanted to say, for example, like I have this pointer to some giant blob of data that's just a sprite sheet or some you know font atlas or something like that. What you can basically say is like, okay, I want to say that this is a bitmap, and then I want to specify some extra information about like what kind of bitmap it is, like how big, how wide is it, how tall is it, what pixel format is it in. And the expression language, like in the debugger watch window, just allows you to express that kind of thing. So you can say like bitmap, and then the first argument it's like a call to bitmap, and you can say here's my pointer, here's my width, here's my height. Those are just expressions, so they can come from variables in your program. And then you can say here's my format, and then you can expand it, and it's going to show you an actual preview of the image itself. You can also like pull it out to your own tab and like see like, oh, like here's a fully featured at the limit. Like once I'm done with it, it'll be fully featured. but it's like, you pull it out to a tab and then it's like, oh, here's a bitmap view. I can pan around, I can zoom in, check the pixel values and all that kind of thing. Now, every visualization feature in the debugger is sort of implemented in this way. So another common one that debuggers will often support is like a memory viewer, like a hex view of some memory. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same feature in the RAD debugger where you can say, okay, memory, let me call memory. Here's my pointer. Here's my size. Like, you can say like number of columns, number, all kinds of parameters that you want to do for building this hex viewer, basically. You expand it. It's just a memory view of whatever parameters you specify to it. As Casey said, there's also a geometry one. So if you have to specify some pieces of information where you can say, like, here's an index buffer, here's a vertex buffer, here's how many indices I have, here's how many vertices I have. I don't know if you need to specify the number of vertices. I have to go look at it. You can basically say this kind of information, and if you expand it, you just get the 3D representation of, like, here's all the geometry data that you actually wanted. And because this is in a watch window, and it's not just, like, parsing a format that you dump out of your program, you see it update live as you step. So you actually, like, step over as these vertices are being built, and you can see the vertices change in real time. So it's way more useful than, like, dumping it and then, dumping it to an OBJ and then looking at, like, some OBJ viewer, like this 3D model or whatever. Same thing with texture data. And so there's also a bunch of other visualization features, like more basic ones, like viewing multi-line text, for example. It's something that every debugger has to do anyways to show you source code, but it's like, you should just be able to apply that same exact path to like just viewing any arbitrary textual data. The disassembly viewer is also implemented this way. It's just a visualizer. And then there's a bunch of different rules that you can introduce to like change how the watch tree, so when you put in like a watch expression, if you expand it, you know, you get rows, generally they're formed by looking at the members of whatever type you expand or something like that. There's a bunch of ways you can customize exactly how that looks like as well. And that's sort of more like sort of what Visual Studio did with NatViz. It's a very similar kind of, although it's not you don't specify that in XML in the RAD debugger, but you can do like the same kind of thing there. And then I guess the final layer, I could dig into more of any of that, but the final layer on top is you can also automatically associate certain types with certain visualizer expressions. So you can go ahead and say, I've got a struct, it's called bitmap, it's got a pointer, a width and a height, and a format. And I'm going to say, if you evaluate this type anywhere in the program, or anywhere, like if you're in the debugger and you're evaluating anything of this type, just automatically say it's a bitmap visualizer. So you're sort of extending type information. You can put this directly in your program, you can put it in the debugger configuration, like really wherever you want. And then anytime you evaluate that in the debugger, by default, it'll show you that visualization automatically. Mm-hmm. So that includes hover evaluation. So if you hover the bitmap variable in your program, you'll see the bitmap just pop up. If you put it in the watch window, it'll just be the bitmap. Like it's, you know, that's sort of the final layer to it, where you can basically extend your program's type info to be automatically associated with this visualization information. Now you can always go back. Like if you're like, I don't want to look at it as a bitmap. I want to look at it as a struct because that's what it is. You could always reverse it. There's a way you can do that inside of the visualization, like, or within the expression syntax as well. So, but yeah, there's lots and lots of stuff you can do. And that's a good first run through, I think.
It also loads fast.
Yeah. I mean, it's not hard to beat Visual Studio. Yeah.
Studio can't beat Visual Studio, so it's more difficult than maybe they think, you know? So just throwing it out there, I feel like it's a cool feature is that it actually loads.
Yeah.
Well, also, I mean, like, some of the things that Ryan was talking about just then are important in the way that I was trying to describe before. In other words, it's really important to remember that a debugger having a feature doesn't matter if it takes you longer to use that feature than printf debugging would have been to find it, right? Mm-hmm. Or yeah. We can extend, like, the phrase printf debugging, we're using that as shorthand because, like, for bitmaps, you wouldn't be printf debugging, but you would be doing a similar thing, which is, like, dumping the bitmap multiple times. I've literally written this code before I had RAD debugger, where, like, in image processing code, I just insert, like, dump image here, dump image here, dump image here, mm-hmm. dump image here, and I look to see, right, like, where did the problem happen, and I'm like, oh, okay, right? And so it has to be faster than that, Because if it's not faster than that, there was no point to the debugger having this feature. And so some of the things that Ryan's talking about are way more important than they sound. The ability just to view something as an image in your debugger isn't enough. It's really crucial to have the ability to also say, look, when I built this program, and this is a really cool feature about debugger, when I built this program, I just included this little macro that I put that acts, sticks some stuff in the type information automatically when I build the program that just says anytime I'm looking at my struct bitmap, you know, structure, it should automatically set it up so that I can view it as the bitmap. That is like one little line of code I put in, and then for the rest of anyone ever using this program inside Rad Debugger, they'll always get it shown as a bitmap automatically with the right width and height and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a massive time savings for everyone. Whereas if it just has this way of like, I load a plugin and then I instantiate the plugin and I say that I want it bound to, like, if I'm doing that every time I have to view my bitmap, it's not saving me the time that I actually needed the debugger for. So all of these things are wicked important. That's why it's so cool, like, that Rad Debugger is taking that approach of like, we actually care about saving you time, not just we cared about writing on the thing, it can view an image, right?
Features can view image. They got the thing on the front page.
That is not enough, right? It needs to be, I can view and debug image processing faster than if I was printf. That is the actual feature you want in the debugger, because otherwise, why were you using it?
Yeah, yeah. You'll see demos of that exact feature too. I don't want to pick on anyone, but you can go look at like demo videos of they're like, look, we can view like images inside of our debugger, and in the demo video, it takes like 10 seconds to load, or like 30 seconds even to load. I can't even remember what it was, but it was just like, it's not just 30 seconds and then you can see it. It's 30 seconds every time you step. Like, it's not updating like right away. So it's just like, how is that helping me? Like, So, and also another good example of printf that's not printf exactly would be graphviz. Like, if you log a bunch of, if you printf a bunch of graphviz, like textual data, you get like a pointer graph view, or you can just, like, print out a pointer graph and then you get this graph structure that you can visualize and see, like, oh, is this tree wrong here, or is it here, or wherever. I haven't implemented this visualizer yet, so it's not in the Rad Debugger yet, but it's like, that's the kind of thing where I'd like to push it, where it's like, no, you can just see your pointer graphs update in real time as you step, and so yeah, that kind of thing would be really nice.
Ryan, we have to write in it. We have to write a real language, though.
I'm sitting here thinking the whole time, like, man, TJ made me do Elixir, and now I can't change. Like, now I want to. I can't change languages just to use a debugger.
We have Observer in Elixir. We have Observer. It is actually good. Like, it actually
Wait,
is good.
Elixir is not a compiled language.
It compiles
to a VM stuff.
Yeah, and then it runs. But the observation tools are very cool because it actually is set up to observe everything across your distributed system, which is like sometimes kind of difficult. They can be running on other computers and everything, right? Like, it's not so simple to do, but Elixir has very nice tooling around this.
Well, that's kind of a bummer, but like, yeah, any compiled language you could be using, like, you know, you could use Rust or something, right? It doesn't have to be C++ frame. If it's compiled and produces debug info, then it can do it. So, you know, you could be using it with Ginger Bill was on. You could use it with Odin, I believe, just fine, right?
No, Ginger Bill, well-known debugger hater, he said it doesn't work for Odin, so...
I doubt
he also
that.
Hates package managers and LSPs as well.
No, that's just a joke from yesterday.
Okay,
don't worry about it.
I happen to know it's false too, because he literally put in special features into the Odin compiler to work better with the Rad Debugger.
Yeah. He was literally in chat 5 seconds ago saying, "I'm gonna go watch from the beginning, so that I can see what's happening. I just wanted to say I use Rad Debugger every day."
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Like,
I can't wait till he gets
Ginger
to this
Bill
part of the episode, and he's gonna be mauling.
I cannot wait for the comment. I actually okay, they were joking.
I'm about to get a very angry email, and then he's gonna watch the rest of the episode.
It was in his BS. It was his Better Software BSC Conf talk. Yeah. He literally pointed. He was like, "Rad Debugger." And he announced that it was coming to macOS, which it's not. So that was
macOS.
That was
maker.
Interesting, right? So I don't know. He basically is forcing. This is a well-known like Gabe Newell tactic. He will just announce something so that then everyone has to ship the thing because it's been said publicly, right? Yeah. And so like he took a page from that playbook as like, well, if I announce it's coming to Mac, it's got to come to Mac. Like,
that's TDD, right? talk-driven development.
Yes! Oh, yes, yes. Right. PDD, press-driven development. Yeah.
Well, I'm very happy, Ryan, you came on the stand-up today to announce Linux is going to be happening in the next few weeks, so thank you very much for doing that.
That's crazy. You heard it here first.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
Thank
and
you.
Last.
And Ryan said Tim Sweeney personally told me that we would be...
There you go. Yep.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, though. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks for explaining how complicated step stuff is.
It's so ridiculous. When you think it's going to be easy, right? It's like, I'm just stepping over this line. It's like, nope.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sorry, buddy.
The recursive one really blew my mind, because that actually just... I mean, that one I was...
Because now you're counting, you're like ref counting, basically, right? Like,
yeah. I thought the stack pointer thing was really clever. Do you use the stack pointer effectively, like save the original address at that time, and then until you return to that stack pointer, you're like, I'm somewhere within the recursive realm.
We do have that path, but we actually figured out something cleverer for the recursive step case. Because generally,
nice try, but actually, you thought of something not stupid.
Okay, first off, owned. Second off, wrecked. All right, so tell my dumbness how you do it then, Ryan.
I remember when I was naive, I thought that might be an option.
Actually, you know what? I want TJ to explain it really quickly.
Yeah. Any time a guest tries to politely say how they did something, TJ is just like, this is an opportunity to make fun of Prime.
Yeah, that's true. For me, stepping's very easy. I just do left foot. Yeah. Right. Right. That's like what I was showing earlier. I literally did a live demo. Here's how I walk. That, dude. I'm stepping right now.
Okay, so what is the cleverer way?
Yeah.
Yes, so the clever way you can do is instead of checking the stack pointer on every recursive, like every recursion downstream of wherever you wanted to step over, you would hit that trap and have to check the stack pointer. What you can do, and so like recursive calls get very expensive to step over that way. What you can do instead is you can basically say when you call into the recursive call, or really whenever you call into anything, because it could call into one function which calls back into the same function. It could be one of those like ping pong recursions. So anytime you call into anything, I want to catch whenever that call returns back to me. Which I can't rely on the code address to do that, because again, it'll hit that trap first. So what I can do instead is basically turn off all the traps that I've set to catch this step, and then I'm just going to completely fake an instruction pointer on the stack. So when you call, it pushes the return address of the instruction pointer onto the stack, and then when the call completes, it'll jump back to that that call address. Yeah. So it's super nice, cuz then you can say after this call happens, it's going to have pushed some address onto the stack, which is the real return address.
I'll romp it.
I'm going to fake that.
Nice.
And then whenever they return, I'll get an exception, not from an int3, but from I just executed some whatever the bogus address was. We happen to use 911. So we just we put 911 in there as the return address, and then we'll get an exception that's like, oh, like I can't even access that page. Like there's no code there. I'm trying to access address 911, and to the debugger that means, oh, you've finished the call, move back to the original return address, and then reset all the traps.
So. Very clever.
Nice.
Question that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions I have, actually.
Okay.
So the first one is...
All right, hold on. I gotta pee.
Oh my god. Okay.
Hey, Prime, nice shirt. Did you guys see a shirt? It's pretty good.
I didn't see
what
a
shirt. What was the
shirt?
Just when he comes back, you'll laugh.
Okay.
Casey, just ask your questions. It's okay. Prime can watch it back later.
Well, can you go grab, like, when they edit this together, grab video of Prime still sitting there going like,
"Oh, smart, very smart."
Right. So it looks like he's watching the whole time.
Well, at the tower, because we used wireless mics. I think one or two times he went pee with the mic still on, and you could hear it in your ears. Trigger an assert when I click here.
That's sick.
Wow. Which is pretty good. That's courtesy of low level.
Hey, can we move at least the line down?
Dude, my goodness. Prime is
getting... Oh god, Prime, he's doing it. No!
That's literally like the Naked Gun, right? Like, that's literally a scene from the first Naked Gun movie.
Yeah. And I had in-ear monitoring, you know, for, like, our mics to make sure levels were fine and stuff. So, like, I'm just sitting here. I'm sitting in the middle of the room, and I just hear him. And I'm like, what is happening?
Prime's peeing again.
Yeah.
Okay. So my first question is, what happens, because I have no idea, what happens in that scenario with, like, the return address, the special return address stack? Does it actually, is it smart enough, is the CPU smart enough to go, like, somebody modified the IP on the actual stack, so I'm gonna, like, go modify the return address stack? Or does the CPU always, I've never looked at this before, does the CPU always check when it pops? You might not know this because maybe it just works. When it actually goes to do a ret, does it just check the return address stack and go, if it didn't match, then I don't do it or something? Or do you know?
To my knowledge, it always will just take the address and jump to it. So okay. it'll and I don't know for sure because it did just work.
Okay.
We're like, let's just phony this address, and then it just went to it. And we were like, okay, it went to it. So then
Ed says yes. 100% you're right, Ryan. Low-level TV confirms in the chat.
Nice.
Confirms what?
Exactly what you said, that it doesn't check.
Ah, okay.
Doesn't check.
Did you say doesn't? It just does check. A pop. I don't know. That's what I just said.
But it has to check. So, just to be clear, inside a lot of CPUs now, there's the stack as you think of the stack, meaning the actual program stack that we push, like, arguments and stuff on, or, like, stack variables or whatever the crap, right? Like, things that don't fit in registers when we're passing or any other things like that. And we push the IPs on there, but that's not where the IPs to return to actually come from. They come from a thing called the shadow stack, right? Which is, like, another thing that's kept as, like, a separate, right? You know what I'm saying? Anyone... And there's also this thing called a return address bar. There's a bunch of things in the CPU that are tracking this information. It's not actually from the stack anymore. Like, that's kind of like old news, right?
Low-level TV is saying the shadow stack is rarely used. They go in the real stack.
But it's there. So what happens if that is... What I'm asking is, what happens if that is on?
We should just get Ed in here, and he should just explain it.
Okay.
Next episode.
That's true. Yeah.
I want to know what happens if you... Because I don't know, like... I assume the CPU actually has, like, some kind of a path for this or something. Meaning, like, it would look and go, like, oh, someone did modify the stack, so I can't just assume that it's...
Yeah.
I don't know. Like... I don't know what they did there. And maybe I can probably just go read it. Like, it's probably in the Intel architecture manual, right? So I will go do that after. But I'm just curious if you ran into it.
Spec. Well, it's probably in the W3C.
Yeah.
I did not run into that.
Okay, it just works.
Basically, I did the naive thing. Yeah, I did the naive thing that assumes it is on the stack, and then it worked.
Yeah.
So
I only know about the Shadow DOM, so...
Shadow DOM. Well, because there's stuff like that where, like, if you do code pages, right? If you do self-modifying code, for example, that doesn't really work anymore unless you invalidate the instruction cache, right? Like, that was a thing that actually broke because of having, like, multiple buffers. So I didn't know if there would be something like that with all these additional ways that return addresses get checked, because they just assume that no one's patching the return address. And so I didn't know if that was an actual assumption. And so you would be like, oh, yeah, we had to call the, like... invalidate the return address stack thing or whatever, right? Or if it just works. And I guess the answer is it just works. My second question was, would a data breakpoint work for that?
You gotta expand on what a data breakpoint is.
If you set a breakpoint where you said this location on the stack, I am setting a breakpoint if anyone reads it or something like this.
Yeah, I guess you could. I guess the reason why you wouldn't want to is to keep those slots open for user breakpoints. Yeah. So I didn't think of doing that, but I think you probably could do that. I don't know if it would catch will that catch instructions that aren't literal reads, but just mechanisms
good
that
point.
The CPU uses to pull the return address? I'm not 100% sure,
right.
But it's a good idea.
Like, would the ret maybe bypasses the data breakpoint? Possibly, right?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. I know nothing, but I'd like to shoot my shot as well. Could you push a fake stack frame on that has a single instruction function that is just an int 3 or whatever the break is, and then continue on and let it go, and then when it comes back, it has to bypass through that function no matter what?
In one sense, we actually started this idea, back when I was prototyping stepping, we started with that idea, we didn't move to 911.
Yes.
Just like, yeah, we tried that. Dumb.
Oh, nice try.
How can I hear from the nicest way since I'm the guest? And
he literally said they started with it. Like, he's basically saying that Prime's idea was good and it was the same idea as them. And Tej is like, well, that means Prime's an idiot. All right. I guess he doesn't know anything.
Dude, I'm collecting L's right now.
Yeah. And like, how did you get there from that? He said they started with it. Like, it was their idea too.
Casey, you have a great point. You're very smart.
Shut up, TJ. TJ just does not want these L's to flow down from you, Casey.
He can't handle you having to win Prime. He can't handle a W in the Prime Corner.
I'm literally wearing an I Love TJ t-shirt.
Oh my god!
Just to like help like bolster his confidence, and he's still dunking on me.
Yeah. True.
Yeah, so we did start with that. We did push an extra frame onto the stack, but we just, instead of moving to 911, we just allocated a code page where there was an int 3, and then we changed the return address to that. But you can save that extra code page injection. Like, it kind of gives you the same effect, but when you move to address 911 instead, you don't have to inject that extra code page and treat int 3s differently. Like, it kind of just gives you, it's just a little bit simpler version of the same idea. Now, I don't think you'd want to push further onto the stack, because then you're kind of changing, like, you know, how deep is this? How deep is their stack? Are they close to a Stack Overflow? Are you doing things that are like, you know, you're kind of changing the way the program is running a little bit too much, I think, in that case. I mean, you could do it though.
You would probably take that approach, Prime, if you actually had some things you needed to do. Like,
right.
Like if you had a really good like a reason for injecting more code, that would probably be the right thing to do, right?
Yeah, so this is, you can actually
Smart
test
Prime.
This too. And
let's go.
This is actually how Visual Studio, like if you're in Visual Studio and you want to evaluate a function, it'll actually do that. So inside the watch window, if you say like, I want to evaluate this function, or in the immediates window probably, you want to evaluate a function to evaluate it, but it's a function from the program, what it'll literally do is take your selected thread and it'll push a new call frame onto it and call whatever function you wanted to run. And you can actually test and verify this. You can put like, call sleep 1000 or whatever. And then if you pause the thread, it's in sleep on top of whatever code you were actually executing. Mm. So it doesn't inject a thread. It just uses whatever thread you had injected or you had selected.
This, but you just insulted me gravely by saying that I have the same level of ideas as Visual Studio, which is a little bit...
That's the meanest thing anyone said to him today.
It hurts. Yeah, dude,
I'm so
you
sorry.
And Visual Studio, same ideas, man.
I want to be clear. I would never. Okay, there's a line between friendly banter and proper insulting, and I would never cross that line for my good friend Brian.
I'm so sorry. I did not. I didn't mean to offend.
Can we get the Primogen subtitle changed to Visual Studio Developer?
He never shows his. Yeah. Even though I write good ones for him.
No, that's because I actually use my real camera as opposed. Yeah. Because if I didn't, I'd actually get the leggy version of me
of
seeing
him.
Myself
yeah.
talking. So I have to use my real camera.
All right. So debuggers, everyone. They're awesome if they're good, and they're useless if they're not. Right, that's the TLDR for this stream, is like if a debugger is awesome, you should use it because it saves you a lot of time, and if it's not, it's just a waste of time, and you can keep doing your printf debugging because it would be just as good. There you go.
Well, I actually do. There is something inside of me that always comes to the same like kind of conclusion, which is I've also not used enough like Vim dapping. I haven't dapped hard enough with the boys yet.
Is that when they do the thing like this?
Oh,
that
Bill Gates does this, which is my favorite version of dapping. But that sometimes I think maybe my speed at a debugger is also skill issues. That maybe I need to actually invest more into learning the dap side of things and the navigation being fast with it. But I also don't run into that issues very often. That it's like, so it's like it's been this kind of a difficult thing. But I need to give Pry. Pry, by the way, is the Elixir version of some level of debugging, so I'd like to pry it up and drop that at printf debugging after this, because you guys make debugger seem so like this like exotic place that I gotta go. But I also don't do game development or C++ or any of those things.
Why don't we do it when you, next time you're gonna be doing a project in a compiled language? Like whenever that next happens, right? We should do a stream where we're like, we'll do some debugging. Like we'll show you what we normally do. So you can just see like here's how we do it.
Let's do a good C. Let's do like I wouldn't do the devil's language C++. Let's do the Lord's language C.
Okay.
Or Odin.
Yeah.
Yeah, Odin could be a great one because Odin's like is actually trying to make stuff good for rad debugging. So let's do that.
Yeah. Both of those will work.
Right. I will say though, the thing, if you're not in like compiled language land like this, when your language has a REPL, you can get some of the experience from when you're running Elixir and you're running like you can run stuff from the REPL. You can send messages. You can go inspect data. You can do other. So there is like. You know, there are some other options, too, that you can explore, even in some of these other languages.
Well, sure, and some VM languages have full debuggers, right? I mean,
Java does, right?
Yep. Even when it's running in a VM, you can do full debugging in Java, right?
Yeah, I think Python has PubG or whatever it's called. That's also like
PubG is the name of the debugger.
In my head, I call it PubG, but I actually can't remember what it is, but it's like PubG.
It's pronounced PubG. It's a video game.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's completely, unless you're playing something completely different than everyone else has been playing, probably.
All I know
PubG
is that,
Underground? Crazy.
Yeah.
All I know is when I saw it, I had such severe dyslexia that all I saw was PubG, and so now I can't unsee it, and so I'm just like, it's PubG. That's what the Python one is. That's all I know.
For some reason, I played PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds for many hours and somehow never thought PubG. And now I will.
Casey, I'm pretty sure if you were on the stand-up when you were playing it same time frame, it would be top of mind, you know?
We should actually do, because I've never played PubG, we should do like a Casey introduces us to PubG.
I mean, it has been so long since I've played it. I would be the worst. We'd just all get shot immediately would be what would happen. I'd be like, I didn't get a chance to show you anything, but sorry, guys. But we can try.
I like that.
Sure, I'd try.
Next stand-up, we'll just play video games
Playing PUBG.
That's actually much closer to a Fang-level startup anyways.
Friday stand-up, time for some team building. Let's pick a video game.
All right, team
building stream would be so funny.
Okay, we'll talk about that offline. I gotta go. I got another podcast.
Oh, sorry. Our bad. Podcast TJ.
Sorry.
Ryan,
have some good ideas. I want it to be clear.
Yeah.
Some good ones.
I appreciate that. Hey, Ryan, where can everybody find you at?
I'm on Twitter or X.
I'm linking it right now.
It's Ryan J. Fleury, Fleury. And then I've got a Substack. I have a couple of blog posts on like debuggers and how they work, and then I've got a bunch of other stuff. That's rfleury, FLEURY.com. and then I think that's basically everything.
Where can they find the rad debugger?
Oh yeah. You can go to github.com/ it's kind of a complicated URL, but it's github.com/ actually, can I put it in the chat?
Yeah.
You can also just search for rad space debugger or epic space rad debugger. In Google it will come up.
Yep.
Yeah. I guess I don't have studio chat. Here we go. I just see
someone already linked it. It's rad games extension rad debugger.
Your fans are in the chat.
Yeah, you got a lot of fans. Is a return address from your Substack 911?
No, but it maybe should be.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Brian, you did it.
I got
he said it's a good idea.
I got one. Take that, universe. All right, everybody, thank you very much for joining us. CaseyComputerEnhanced.com if you want to actually learn how computers work. TJ, he streams, by the way, and the name is the Primogen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very
TJ,
much.
That was a great outro. I
that
nailed
was so
that.
Good.
That was pretty damn good.
Thank you.
Boot up the day. Vibe coding errors on my screen. Terminal coffee in hand. Living.